Hello, and welcome to the first of 12 monthly episodes on the Prostate Cancer Clinical Masterclass series. This is an independent educational initiative organized by the Clinical Comms Group. My name is Gert Attard. I'm a medical oncologist in University College London, UK. And along with my co-chair, Sumeet Subbudi from MD Anderson, US, I'm delighted to welcome you to this inaugural session, which I'm certain is going to be a great start. We welcome two clinical experts, Veeru Kasivisvanathan, who is one of my colleagues here in University College London, but doing a sabbatical at Peter Mac in Melbourne, Australia. And he'll be joining Michael Hoffman, well known from Peter Mac, who is a nuclear medicine physician and physician scientist and director of the Prostate Cancer Theranostics and Imaging Center of Excellence in Melbourne. We'll start with Michael, who'll be discussing the topic of theranostics and prostate cancer, which he's really driven the field so far forward. And I know from having listened to many of Michael's talks that he's an excellent speaker and packs his talks with useful information.
Thank you, Gert, and it's my pleasure to present this Prostate Cancer Clinical Masterclass series, and I'll be talking about theranostics in prostate cancer. Here are some of my disclosures. So lutetium PSMA-617 is the latest FDA-approved theranostic. We have a number of predecessors, such as lutetium dotatate, radium-223, radioimmunotherapy for lymphoma, or way back to radioactive iodine for thyroid cancer, which was first used in the 1930s. So the concept of using a radionuclide as a therapeutic is not new, but this is the latest advance. And in this slide, you can see on the top the date that these molecules were first used in people, and then the date it was FDA approved. And we can see that lutetium PSMA-617 has really happened rather quickly over less than a decade. Now, this compares to almost 20 years for approval of lutetium dotatate in neuroendocrine tumors. The principles underlying the patient selection and the treatment in all these various forms of radionuclide therapy are somewhat similar. In this slide, in the next slide, we'll go through the overarching principle of theranostics. The word theranostics is half therapy and half diagnostics. And that's because we're using the same radioactive molecule for both diagnostics, usually with PET-CT scanning, and also for treatment. So for the imaging part, we use a positron-emitting radionuclide, such as gallium-68 or fluorine-18. These are molecules that are injected intravenously. They travel around the body, bind to receptors on the surface of tumors, and they then emit essentially positrons or gamma rays that are detected by the PET scanner, and we have three-dimensional whole body images of the radionuclide distribution. For prostate cancer, we're using small molecules that bind to prostate-specific membrane antigen, or PSMA. If the target is expressed in abundance, which we can see by viewing the PET scan, then we can do a neat trick by using a very similar molecule, but simply changing the type of radioactive label. And for the therapy here, we are using lutetium-177, which is a short path length beta emitter that has a half-life of around 7 days. So the principle is the same as the imaging. We inject it intravenously. Its biodistribution is virtually identical to what we see with the imaging compound, but the radiation emitted is completely different. The beta rays traveling only 1 millimeter and having very high energy. So they're trapped within the prostate cancer cells or tumor complexes. And this high energy results in single or double-stranded DNA breaks and thereby tumor eradication or shrinkage. As I've alluded to, here we are targeting PSMA or prostate-specific membrane antigen. This is a cell surface receptor that's highly overexpressed in castration-resistant metastatic prostate cancer. And the two main forms of imaging, which are now both FDA approved, is gallium-68 PSMA-11 or fluorine-18 DCF-PyL. This is more expressed in higher grade tumors, metastatic disease, or castration resistant disease, which is exactly the group of patients where there's a compelling need for new therapeutics. We did the first prospective phase two trial of this agent at our center at Peter MacCallum Cancer Center in Melbourne. And we took 30 patients that was then expanded to a 50 patient study who had progressed after all forms of therapy, including docetaxel, enzalutamide, abiraterone, and more than half this cohort progressing after cabazitaxel. And we really saw unprecedented responses with a PSA reduction of 50% or more in 64% of men. This was published in Lancet Oncology in 2018 and led to the evolving interest in this area and development of two randomized control trials. Here are the eight best responders out of the 50 in this trial, and we can see the gallium PSMA PET scan before and after four cycles of lutetium PSMA. And what we can see is that the PET scans really show us very neatly the distribution and extent of prostate cancer. Here we're using colorization to highlight prostate cancer in red. This was done by highlighting any tumor with an SUV over 3. In small print below each figure, we can see the corresponding PSA drop. It's important to bear in mind that these are the eight best responders out of the 50 and is not representative of really your average responders. And there certainly are a group of patients who don't respond to this treatment. We selected patients in this trial using both a PSMA PET, but additionally an FDG PET. And in this patient, we can see that there are quite extensive liver metastases that are FDG positive, but PSMA negative. We can think of lutetium PSMA 617 as a radiation delivery device. It has analogies to external beam radiation. And if the target is not expressed, we will not deliver radiation and it will be ineffective. So we can predict with a very high degree of certainty that this treatment will not be effective in the liver metastases in this patient. We can color code this to produce some nice pictures. And in red, we can see the disease that is FDG positive and PSMA negative that cannot be targeted. Now, in this case, if we didn't have the FDG PET, we could look very closely at the contrast in the enhanced CT because these liver metastases are visible. And similarly, we would be able to see that the liver metastases are PSMA negative. So to some extent, the FDG PET is optional, but a quite an elegant way to identify these PSMA negative sites of disease. Where the FDG helps over a contrast enhanced CT are sites of so-called discordant disease within bone, because they're not readily visible on the CT scan. And prostate cancer likes spreading to bone, and this is where there is potentially an added advantage of the FDG compared to contrast enhanced CT. We now have two randomized controlled trials of lutetium PSMA 617. On the left, our own Australian investigator-initiated phase two study, the therapy study run by the ANZUP Cooperative Trials Group. And on the right, the large industry-sponsored VISION trial, an over 800 patient study, which has led to FDA registration and widespread availability. So let's go through both these studies. They were both very similar patient groups. We will discuss some of the differences. Both used PSMA PET to select patients who are suitable for therapy. And as I've alluded to, the therapy study also used FDG PET, whereas the VISION trial relied on contrast enhanced CT. Here are some differences in patient selection. Both trials using a gallium PSMA PET scan, but slightly different intensity thresholds. In the therapy study, we required at least one site of disease with an SUV max over 20, which corresponds to an intensity somewhere above physiologic salivary gland activity. However, in the VISION trial, the threshold was set a little bit lower, requiring an SUV above liver. In both studies, if there were any sites of PSMA negative disease that were measurable, either using FDG in the therapy study or contrast enhanced CT in the VISION trial, these patients were excluded. Beyond imaging selection, here are some other criteria that were required for patient selection, both trials being post at least one line of taxane chemotherapy, that's docetaxel, or an androgen receptor pathway inhibitor, such as abiraterone or enzalutamide. Both trials required adequate hematologic, liver, and renal function, and other criteria being fairly similar. We'll take you through the therapy study firstly. As I've alluded to, this was a phase two study, a 200-patient study conducted at 11 sites around Australia. We took men with castration-resistant disease post-docetaxel, 91% had progressed after either abiraterone or enzalutamide, and they were randomised to either standard of care carboxytaxel or the experimental arm being lutetium PSMA 617. The primary endpoint in this study was a PSA reduction over 50%. And we saw that this occurred in 66% of men randomized to lutetium PSMA 617 compared to 37% of men with carboxytaxel. That's a 29% absolute difference in this primary endpoint. And here we can see the waterfall plots of best PSA responses. And you'll also appreciate that there's a significant group of patients, almost a third, who had a really deep PSA response with reductions perhaps over 90%. Secondary endpoint in this study was progression-free survival, and we can see that the median PFS was actually similar in both arms at around 5.1 months, but then the curves separated so that by 12 months, almost all patients had progressed following carboxytaxel, whereas around 20% of patients had not progressed at 1 year after treatment with lutetium PSMA 617. This left a hazard ratio of 0.63 favoring lutetium PSMA 617. More recently, at the ASCO meeting in 2022, we presented the longer-term follow-up of this study. Before I describe that, just noting that responses were not just related to PSA or PFS, but another objective criteria being tumour shrinkage by CT resist occurred much more frequently, 49% with lutetium compared to 24% with carboxytaxel. With an average of 3-year survival, we did not see a difference in overall survival between lutetium PSMA 617 and carboxytaxel, with a restricted mean survival time of around 19 months in both arms, hazard ratio 0.97. There was post-protocol crossover, meaning that lutetium PSMA was available in Australia, so patients randomised to carboxytaxel, around 20%, did access lutetium, and also around 15% of patients randomised to carboxytaxel withdrew their consent, and many of these patients went on to receive lutetium PSMA 617, and this was an intention-to-treat analysis. So both these factors confounding our ability to evaluate overall survival, which was a secondary endpoint in this phase two design. In terms of quality of life, this really favoured lutetium PSMA 617. On the left, we see deterioration-free survival. This is time to a 10-point deterioration in global health status, progression, death, or treatment discontinuation. So really a very patient-relevant endpoint. And we can see that this strongly favours lutetium PSMA really at any time point. And then we looked at a number of symptoms, and you can see these generally favour lutetium PSMA with significantly less skin rash, neuropathy, hair loss, altered taste, lightheadedness, urinary symptoms, diarrhea, insomnia, fatigue, and improved social functioning in the groups in men randomised to lutetium PSMA. Now we come to the phase three vision trial. This trial was run by Novartis, and over 800 men were randomised to lutetium PSMA 617 in combination with standard of care, compared to standard of care alone. Standard of care, however, was protocol defined, and this did not include systemic therapies such as carboxytaxel or radium, immunotherapy, PARP inhibitors, and so on. So the standard of care was essentially a crossover androgen therapy, such as enzalutamide following abiraterone, or other treatments such as external beam radiation. This trial also selected patients, and we can see that around 5% of patients had no positive PSMA avid lesions, defined as intensity above liver, and another 9% had signs of PSMA negative measurable disease on the contrast enhanced CT and were thereby excluded. Here's an example of a patient with liver metastases where the uptake is not greater than background liver activity and therefore resulting in patient exclusion. Here's the primary endpoint of the study, overall survival, and it favoured lutetium-PSMA 617 with a hazard ratio of 0.62, median of 15.3 months compared to 11.3 months for standard of care. Importantly, the VISION trial also showed not only improvements in survival, but also significant improvements in quality of life. Here we see the time to a worsening of the FACT-P total score, median 9.7 months compared to 2.4 months, hazard ratio 0.46. We can see a very large separation in the Kaplan-Meier curve. This was also true for pain. Here is time to worsening in the brief pain index, median of 14.3 months compared to only 2.9 months in the standard of care. So a very large difference between these two arms, hazard ratio 0.45. And this is one of the key benefits of lutetium-PSMA 617. It's got a very low side effect profile. So with tumor control, patients experience significant improvements in quality of life. In terms of side effects, this slide highlights the key adverse effects in both the VISION trial on the left and the therapy trial on the right in both arms. Highlighting the key toxicities in yellow, dry mouth occurred in 40 to 60% of men, exclusively grade 1 to 2, nausea in 30 to 40% of men, anemia and thrombocytopenia being grade 3 to 4 in around 10% of men. Here's a practical overview of at least how we run our theranostic service at Peter Mac. Our referrals are generally coming from medical oncologists, and after an initial nuclear medicine consultation, either in person or via telehealth, we discuss all new patients in our multidisciplinary meeting. And if the patient is deemed suitable, we then order the dose, give the patient instructions, including radiation advice. You know, the logistics of giving lutetium-PSMA 617 are somewhat more complicated than what many of you will be used to, because the lutetium has a half-life of 7 days. It's a reactor-produced product, so it needs to be ordered for each individual patient. It can't be sitting around in your pharmacy ready to be dispensed whenever you want it. And there's generally a lead time of anywhere from 14 to 21 days in advance where you need to order a dose for an individual patient. The radiation protection requirements vary in different countries. In Australia and the USA, this is given as an outpatient treatment where the patient comes as an injection of lutetium therapy and generally after a very short period of time of only a few hours are allowed to be discharged from the hospital. At our centre, we do post-therapy imaging at 24 hours and then consult the patient afterwards. However, this is not standard of care in all countries. So, for example, in the therapy trial, 24-hour post-therapy imaging was performed, whereas in the VISION trial, this was not performed. We then check blood tests at 3 weeks and 5 weeks and plan for the next cycle. And important to maintain review by the patient's treating clinician throughout. This is really a close collaboration where a multidisciplinary approach is really needed. This involves nuclear medicine, working with medical oncology, urology, radiation oncology, palliative care, etc., for optimal patient selection, safe delivery of the lutetium, and follow-up. Here, this slide summarizes some of the toxicities that you might see and how to deal with them. Nausea and vomiting is usually grade 1, and can be mitigated by administration of ondansetron. And in some patients with bone pain or at high risk of bone pain, we will administer dexamethasone concurrently as well. Dry mouth is usually mild, but in around 10 to 20% of patients, it can be more severe. And sometimes some artificial salivary supplements, such as Xylemelts, can be helpful. We can see anemia, and we want to prevent renal toxicity by making sure patients are well hydrated. And in our centre, we give some IV hydration around the time of lutetium administration. Post-treatment, here the main side effects are listed, and they may require a dose reduction if certain thresholds are reached. So if platelet counts in a DIA less than 100, which generally occurs within 30 days, then we will reduce the next dose by 20%. The thrombocytopenia is the main reason for subsequent dose reductions. If platelets don't recover, this may require a dose delay. Otherwise, we administer up to 6 cycles every 6 weeks. In terms of treatment discontinuation, if the patient is no longer clinically benefiting, this is the key parameter that's used to stop lutetium PSMA therapy. Unacceptable toxicity is really a very rare indication because this is such a well-tolerated treatment. In some patients, we see exceptional responses and we don't need to necessarily administer all six cycles. So how many cycles? Initially, six cycles every 6 weeks. In the therapy trial, we did post-therapy imaging after each cycle, and if there was a complete response, which we described as no tumor uptake greater than liver at any site, then we paused treatment and we recommenced treatment upon PSA rise. In the VISION trial, four cycles were given, and if that was deemed beneficial for the patient, then a further two cycles were given. The median number of cycles in both trials that were actually administered was five. In terms of when to stop treatment, you need to know when to stop because not all patients make it through to six cycles, just like any other form of treatment. So in patients with progressive disease that's PSMA positive, if they're not having side effects, they don't have any other treatment options, and if we think the patient's clinically benefiting, we'll generally proceed with the next cycle. However, if there's progressive disease, especially if it's PSMA negative, if the patient's got significant side effects, if the patient has another good treatment option, which may be cabazitaxel, or we think clinically the patient's not benefiting, these are reasons to stop lutetium PSMA therapy. And post-therapy imaging can be helpful just to define if that disease is remaining PSMA positive. Recently, I was involved in this publication, which was a collected effort of four or five centers with over 270 patients defining this normogram. And this is available online. And you plug in parameters as on the left, and it will give you a predicted overall survival, probability of PSA response, and estimated PSA progression-free survival. And we integrated a quantitative PET parameter at baseline, the tumor SUV mean. This is the average intensity of tumor uptake on your PET scan. This is not a parameter that you probably get routinely on your PET reports today. It does require some advanced software and some contouring of all the tumor index. But in this study and others, it has been found that this is a predictive and prognostic biomarker. So the higher the tumor uptake on your baseline PET scan, the higher radiation delivery you'll get and the better the responses to lutetium PSMA therapy. Now, with an average survival of around 15 to 18 months in the VISION and the therapy trials, we do need to do better. And this slide and review article highlights some of the things that are currently being studied in order to take this therapy to the next level. And I won't go through them, but the broad principles here are combining lutetium PSMA 617 with other treatments, or using it earlier, or selecting patients better, or using other methods of advanced imaging analysis to really select which patients are likely to respond. So, in conclusion, lutetium PSMA 617 is a new class of effective therapy with a low side effect profile. Its current indication is post an androgen receptor pathway inhibitor and taxane chemotherapy. We see increasing response rates with increasing PSMA intensity. And as this is a new treatment, it needs to be delivered as a close collaboration between medical oncology, nuclear medicine, urology, and radiation oncology. There are many trials underway combining lutetium PSMA with other treatments or using this treatment earlier. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you, Michael. What a tour de force. You've really covered all the salient points on theranostics in such an elegant way. Our next speaker is Veeru Kasivanathan, who is an academic urological surgeon, one of my colleagues based here at University College London, UK, but is currently in a sabbatical at the Peter Mac. He just spent the day with Michael, and I know he's having a great and really rewarding time there. So inviting Veeru to present on the topic of the best use of MRI for prostate cancer diagnosis, which again, Veeru was instrumental in driving this field forward and really resulting in a paradigm change in how we diagnose our patients.
So thank you for the kind introduction. Now we're going to move from the treatment of advanced prostate cancer to the diagnosis of prostate cancer in the first place. And I'm going to talk about the best use of MRI for prostate cancer diagnosis. So if we look at where we are today in 2022, we can see from the EAU guidelines that MRI influences whether a biopsy is performed, how that biopsy is performed, and more than that, it influences treatment suitability and delivery plan. And a lot of these changes in how we manage patients and diagnose them with cancer have been made as a result of studies in the last 5 to 10 years. And I'll take you through some of this evidence now, which will allow you to make your own judgment about how best to use MRI. So the PROMISE study was a study published in The Lancet in 2017. It was a multi-center UK study in 11 sites, looking at 576 men with a clinical suspicion of prostate cancer. They had a 1.5 Tesla multiparametric MRI scan, followed by which they had a general anesthetic with two biopsies carried out in the same sitting procedure, with the first biopsy being a detailed 5 mm transperineal template prostate biopsy, and the second being a 12-core truss biopsy. And the MRI results were blinded to the operators performing that biopsy. They then unblinded the MRI and compared the results of the MRI and the truss biopsy to the detailed transperineal template biopsy. The primary outcome was the diagnostic test performance, with the definition used as the primary of Gleason grade 4+3 or greater, and or maximum cancer core length of 6 mm. They also looked at a few other definitions for cancer significance. And if we look at the misses by prostate MRI, one of the important things that this study shows us is that MRI missed no Gleason 4+3, i.e. the cancers that people think are bad and are going to affect the patient's prognosis potentially are not missed by MRI in this study. The truss biopsy missed 19% of patients with 3+4 or greater. And when we look at how this translates to test performance, MRI had a greater sensitivity than truss biopsy, a greater negative predictive value than truss biopsy, but it did have a low positive predictive value, which was primarily due to the false positives, which suggests that a positive MRI is not enough. You still need a biopsy to confirm that there's significant cancer there. So the PROMISE study concluded that MRI was superior to truss biopsy in the detection of clinically significant cancer, and MRI should be used as a triage test prior to biopsy in biopsy-naive men with suspected prostate cancer. One of the major limitations of the PROMISE study was that there were no targeted biopsies carried out in PROMISE, which we know are part of the standard diagnostic approach which many people take. And it assumed that the targeted biopsies would be as good as the transperineal template biopsies used in the study. Let's pause for a minute and think outside of a high-quality clinical trial. Let's look across a number of other studies and see in contemporary practice, does the negative predictive value seen in PROMISE hold across other studies? And this study by Sathyanathan et al. Was a systematic review looking at contemporary studies and MRI performance, showing that in fact, the 91% negative predictive value demonstrated here was actually higher than that seen in PROMISE. So MRI does perform well outside of a clinical trial setting as well. So we try to address some of the limitations in PROMISE, looking at targeted biopsy directly within a trial setting. And we, as a group, as part of the START Consortium, which you can see in the picture on the right, met in New York back in 2012-2013. And we wanted to design a study which could change practice from standard of care of truss biopsy to a pathway involving MRI. So we designed the PRECISION study, which looked at men with clinical suspicion of prostate cancer who were randomized to either the 10 to 12 core truss biopsy, which was standard of care, or a multiparametric MRI with T2-weighted, diffusion-weighted, and contrast-enhanced sequences. If the MRI was negative, they got no biopsy. And if the MRI was positive, they got a targeted biopsy only with up to 4 cores per suspicious area. Now, this was the first study in which patients with a negative MRI had no biopsy at all, and then with a positive MRI had a targeted biopsy only. So really, we were waiting the result of this study with bated breath, because prior to this, people did not believe that you could just do targeted biopsy alone or avoid biopsying men with a negative MRI. The primary outcome of the study focused on the detection of significant cancer, which was defined as Gleason 3 plus 4 or greater. And looking at the outcomes of the study, we can see that actually 28% of men avoided a biopsy in the MRI arm. There were a median of 4 cores in the MRI and targeted biopsy arm compared to 12 in the TRUST biopsy arm. For the primary outcome, we can see that a greater proportion of patients, 38 compared to 26, had significant cancer detected by the targeted biopsy arm compared to TRUST biopsy arm. And however this was analyzed, it showed that MRI and targeted biopsy was superior in the detection of clinically significant cancer to TRUST biopsy. So for some of the key secondary outcomes, there were fewer men with insignificant cancer detected by the MRI pathway. The maximum cancer core length of the cancers was slightly greater. And the proportion of cores positive for cancer was greater with the MRI arm. So the conclusion from the precision study was that an MRI-targeted biopsy strategy results in fewer men needing biopsy with fewer biopsy cores, more significant and less insignificant cancer detected, and a more favorable 30-day patient-reported complication profile. Now, again, when we think that the precision study was a multi-center study carried out with maybe stricter management of how the protocols were done, let's think outside of the box and think, what's better than one randomized controlled trial looking at the role of MRI? Well, 2 randomized controlled trials and a meta-analysis of that data. So actually, what we did when we designed the precision study is we designed a parallel sister study to be carried out just in Canada, which is the PRECISE study led by Laurie Klotz and the Canadian group, with both studies following a very similar protocol with plans to meta-analyze the data at the end of the study. Now that practice has changed to allowing MRI to be carried out in all men, having equipoise to randomize to an arm without MRI is no longer going to be easily possible. So this data is quite valuable. And the VISION study, which is a different VISION study to the one that Michael spoke about, this is now in the primary diagnostic setting, is an individual patient data meta-analysis of the 2 big trials, which provides level 1A evidence for the role of MRI. And we presented this earlier this year at the EAU Congress. So the 2 headline outcomes we'll talk about are the detection of significant cancer, which you can see here when you meta-analyze the data from both studies, do in fact show that MRI arm is superior to the TRUST biopsy arm by 8.7%. And for insignificant cancer detection, far fewer men have insignificant cancer detection by the MRI arm. So again, if we look wider across more paired cohort type studies, which are primarily retrospective in nature, but more reflect the real world practice, we can see that for the positive MRI, men with a suspicious MRI, targeted biopsy does in fact perform better than TRUST biopsy and systematic biopsy. So further evidence highlighting its role. So the next question is, does it matter how you do these targeted biopsies? So we know there are a number of different methods, a visual registration or cognitive registration, where the operator looks at the MRI in advance and uses their own judgment as to where to put the biopsy cores. Software-assisted fusion, where a piece of software will help the operator superimpose the MRI image onto the real-time ultrasound in front of them. Or in-bore MRI-targeted biopsy, where the biopsy is done in an interventional MRI magnet. And a study by Olivia Weglin compared the 3 techniques in a systematic review and overall showed the detection rates of the significant cancer were no different. However, they wanted to design a study which was a prospective randomized study, which they delivered, which was called a future trial. And they published this in European Urology. And this actually also showed there was no significant difference between the 3 techniques in significant cancer detection. However, as you can see from the actual percentages there, for cognitive detection, it was 44%, and in-bore, it was 55%. And this study was clearly underpowered, and there is potentially room for a further study in the future to delineate the different roles. So we now move on to the role of systematic biopsy. We've shown from some of the randomized data that the targeted biopsy alone is pretty good. How about if you do the targeted biopsy and the systematic biopsy together? Now, this question was addressed by the MRI First study, which was a multi-center French study in 16 sites with 251 men with clinical suspicion having an MRI. If the MRI was suspicious, they had two biopsies, the first with a 12-bore trough biopsy, and a second operator would perform a targeted biopsy. And if the MRI was non-suspicious, they would just have a 12-bore trough biopsy. And the primary outcome was Gleason 3 plus 4 or greater. And this was actually quite similar between both of the arms. Looking at the secondary outcome of higher grade prostate cancer, 4 plus 3 or greater, this was greater with the MRI arm. When we look at the added value of the targeted biopsies and the systematic biopsies, we can see that overall both techniques detected 25% of the cancers, with 8% of them being detected purely by the MRI targeted biopsy and 5% purely by the truss biopsy. However, when we look at the higher grade cancers, which potentially matter more, you can see that both techniques detected 14%, MRI targeted biopsy with 6%, and the truss biopsy uniquely detecting 1%. So the conclusion of the MRI First study was that MRI and targeted biopsy did not detect more 3 plus 4 than truss biopsy, but it did detect more 4 plus 3. And to maximize 3 plus 4 detection, if that's what the aim of the person's diagnostic scheme is, targeted biopsies should be added to systematic biopsy. So that kind of summarizes where we are today with prostate cancer diagnosis and where the guidelines, which are EAU guidelines and also American guidelines and some from the UK, are in their position. If the patient has a negative MRI, in many cases you can avoid a biopsy and perhaps ask for a biopsy only in those with patients who are at high risk, which we'll go through in a bit. For those with a positive MRI, you can perform a targeted plus or minus systematic biopsy with your choice of performing systematic biopsy, dependent on whether the patient was biopsy naive or has had a prior negative biopsy. The question is, how do some of these biomarkers fit in with MRI? And there are a number of blood-based biomarkers and urine-based biomarkers, and their role really depends on the healthcare system in which one is asking the question, as the costs of the investigation, such as MRI, can vary quite a lot. For example, they're quite expensive in North America, whereas in Europe and Australia, some of these tests are a lot cheaper, whereas the biomarkers are quite expensive in places like Europe. So one of the tests I mentioned, where you identify a patient with a negative MRI who may be at high risk, is PSA density. And we know that there's good evidence that if you have a high PSA density and a negative MRI, you may still wish to offer a patient a biopsy. And there are a number of other studies which have looked at the role of some of these blood-based biomarkers, such as the Stockholm 3 biomarker, which have shown to be quite valuable in the diagnostic setting. Personally, I think they have two main roles. The biomarkers can be used either to help identify patients who should go on to an MRI, or in patients who have a negative MRI, it can be used to improve that negative predictive value of the MRI so that they can avoid a biopsy altogether. One of the things to note about biomarkers in general is they don't give you any localization information on where the cancer is. They don't influence how a biopsy is performed and do not necessarily influence treatment suitability and plan, whereas the MRI information, of course, will give you some of those things. And this summarizes where the EAU guideline sees the role of biomarkers with weak evidence towards the choice of an additional serum, urine, or tissue-based biomarker. There are a number of other associated things we could talk about in the time that we have today. We'll mention two of these things. The first being MRI quality. And in any study where we look at how MRI is used, one of the things that's lacking from the literature is how good quality the MRI was. And we know this is the big issue from analyses from the PRECISION study. And one of the things that can help people understand the quality of the MRI used in the study and the quality of MRI in their own centers is the pQAL scoring system, which is developed from the PRECISION trial. So I'd encourage you to also think about the quality of the MRI scans used at your center or in a study before making decisions on how you manage your patients. The second thing I'd mention is capacity for MRI. So we know that MRI is a good thing. We've shown there is strong level one evidence for its use. However, how can we increase the capacity for scans? Because at the moment, not everyone who needs an MRI scan will be getting one, whether it's for cost reasons or capacity reasons. So if we break down what the MRI is involved in these studies, they're primarily multiparametric MRIs, which are ones which comprise of T2-weighted, diffusion-weighted, and contrast-enhanced sequences. Now, one way of potentially increasing capacity is to take out the contrast-enhanced sequences, leaving you with a biparametric MRI. That would also mean you don't need to give them a cannula to give the injection of contrast. It avoids the need for a doctor and additional staff in cases of a potential contrast allergy reaction, which is otherwise a mandatory requirement. You don't need to use the gadolinium contrast, which we know has been shown to deposit in the basal ganglia, although there's no evidence for what effect that might have. And in addition, it does give you a shorter scan. The contrast sequences can often add about 10 minutes with the time taken to administer it. And that means you could perform more scans in the same time with the same scanner. So many more patients could benefit from an MRI scan across a population level. Now, there is a study currently being carried out to investigate this called PRIME, which is looking at whether biparametric MRI is non-inferior to multiparametric MRI in the detection of significant cancer. And this will potentially allow many more centers to benefit from the use of MRI. We'll talk you through some of the study and the rationale for it, and hopefully you can look out for the results in the coming years. So we know the previous studies looking at this comparison show that the performance is similar. However, most of them have small sample sizes. The scoring system used is limited in that it won't show a difference between the two. There isn't necessarily targeted biopsy, and there's no strict blinding of a radiologist when reporting the different MRI scans. So we tried to address that in the PRIME study with a 500 patient within patient study, which is currently being carried out in patients with suspected prostate cancer with a PSA of less than 20 and who have not had previous investigations before. And the primary outcome is significant cancer detection, and this may allow us to redefine the standard of care for prostate cancer diagnosis. And as mentioned, it's a within-patient study, which gives the design quite an efficient design, which will hopefully be carried out in a shorter time period. It's being carried out across 32 centers across the world. We have centers from Europe, centers from North America, and centers from South America and Australia as well. So we're trying to assess this across a number of different healthcare settings. Recruitment's been going well. In the first 6 months, we've recruited 50 patients and we're opening more sites and we'll accelerate ahead. And the vision is to try and define a new standard of care for prostate cancer diagnosis so that every man who needs an MRI can get one. The last thing I'll leave you on is maybe something that really ready for future research that we've started looking at. And it's whether MRI can be used even earlier on in the diagnostic pathway. So all of the evidence we've spoken about are looking at how MRI can be used in patients who are selected with a raised PSA and or abnormal to the colorectal exam. Looking at MRI as a population screening test is actually taking healthy patients of a certain age group and then having them have an MRI and investigating them further based on that finding, so not necessarily based on a prior PSA triage. And early results of this were published in the Prostagram study in JAMA Oncology, which were quite encouraging. And there is a study called Reimagine, which is currently going on based at UCL, which is looking at the feasibility of such an approach, which of course would potentially alter the risk-benefit balance of screening for prostate cancer. And with that, time has come to an end, and happy to take any questions for the discussion. Thank you.
Veeru, Michael, thank you. That was really excellent. You've hit the sweet spot between keeping it engaging and giving so much useful clinical information. So some questions, and I've jotted down many through your talks. I'll start with Vero. So you alluded to this at the end, Vero, that all the MRI data we have to date is in PSA-instigated testing. How will this differ if we don't have PSA? And maybe this is just more philosophical, because you may not have data on that setting. But of course, so moving away from PSA, how will that influence all the trials that you and others have run?
So look, a good starting point is the randomized trials of PSA screening and looking at how we can improve on that. So the ERSPC did show a prostate cancer specific mortality benefit from using PSA screening. And the major limitations are overdetection. So you identify patients at an earlier stage who may not benefit from treatment, but end up getting it. So when we look at how MRI could improve that situation, we believe MRI is a really good test for identifying patients who need treatment and avoiding the diagnosis of cancer that doesn't need treatment. So if you shift the balance in that favor and use that test up front, you may provide a better prostate cancer specific mortality with less overtreatment.
That makes sense. Now, one thing that's unclear to me is how targeted biopsies influence the ultimate Gleason sum or score that's provided to us oncologists. So that's not exactly the same question as what you presented about detection of the number of 4+3s or 3+4s. So do you have a handle for how targeted biopsies are ultimately influencing Gleason, which we then sometimes use to decide on treatment?
Yeah, so you know, your Gleason scores, when you look at a biopsy, the pathologist will look at the length of cancers of that type of pattern involved. And so it can influence what Gleason score you get if you target a lesion and get a sample straight through the center of an area of suspicion. So in a way, it sometimes would suggest that you're almost altering the risk profile of patients that you're getting through the system. Overall, I think that's a good thing. It means we have to be judicious about how we interpret that information. But it also means that we have a risk of patients in whom, on the lower end of the scale, who we can probably reassure ourselves really don't need treatment. And there's a group of patients in between who need active surveillance, but we're more confident now we've accurately sampled the disease and represented what's going on. So we think about trust biopsy and what it misses. There are quite a few misses which we don't see in the current stage with MRI and targeted biopsy.
I guess I agree. I agree with that. That makes sense. But we're currently, because of an absence of long-term follow-up data on the extent from trust biopsies versus targeted, we're transposing our risk assessments or risk stratification using Gleason into patients who've had a targeted biopsy, which was built on patients who've had a trust biopsy. What are the possible risks with doing that?
Yeah, so look, one of the things which can happen is you can have the same cancer, which you diagnose with a targeted biopsy, that might appear to have maybe a bigger cancer core length or even a different overall Gleason score. And that cancer previously may have been treated with maybe active surveillance or may have even been missed. And now you're potentially suggesting some radical treatment. So that's an extreme example of the risks involved with adopting any kind of new diagnostic test. But it's about being able to use the information and manage it in a safe manner, which I think in the context of the studies and clinical practice we have with the clinicians who see the patients, it's possible to do that and is done. We do it routinely. And one other thing to mention to think about is, do we need to think about the risks of patients and their prognosis beyond the Gleason score and cancer core length, the volume of cancer? And I think the MRI as a prognostic test has actually shown to predict outcome quite well. So when you look at some of the studies and the genes involved in aggressivity of cancer, or visible compared to non-visible disease, a lot of these genes are upregulated in visible disease more so than non-visible disease. And when you look at the longer-term outcomes, i.e. prostate cancer-specific mortality and metastases, particularly from our own active surveillance series published in European Urology, these outcomes are actually worse for patients with MRI-visible disease. So actually, it confers a different prognosis if you've got an MRI-visible lesion which has been targeted, separate to the Gleason score and volume, which I think is important to consider as well.
So on that subject, you briefly talked about blood and urine, not briefly, but you talked about blood and urine biomarkers, and you said that the utility you saw was to test the high-risk patients who are MRI negative, or no lesion was seen on MRI, or pre-MRI to better select between PSA and MRI to better select who should get an MRI. What about risk stratification? So, which will then inform on subsequent treatment in an MRI diagnosed or MRI assessed population?
Yeah, that's also a potential role. Again, let's think about the healthcare setting. So in the UK, these tests are quite expensive and they're not difficult. They're quite difficult to get access to. And so in an NHS setting, we don't have approval for use of these routinely. Whereas if you look at the US, where an MRI scan will cost a couple of thousand dollars, suddenly these biomarkers become far more useful in that setting. So yeah, there are biomarkers available for doing that and giving you a prognosis score based on what the genetic test tells you, for example. And there is a potential role for it in that setting, but just not in the UK NHS practice, for example.
Michael,
I want to jump in and ask a bit of a theoretical question, because I don't think you should be using PSMA PET in this very early stage like you're using multiparametric MRI today. But, you know, data from 20 years ago, when PSMA was cloned, showed that it was overexpressed in higher Gleason score tumors. And we see that in clinical practice, and you know, that makes it a good target in the castration-resistant disease patients. So it does seem that intensity of PSMA uptake may be a useful biomarker. And we certainly see, even in patients with widespread metastatic disease, that the prostate primary is lighting up very brightly. And in the staging setting, it's very good for looking at the primary disease in the prostate gland. How do you think PSMA PET will evolve in that role, you know, either as a complementary test to multiparametric MRI or even as a replacement? Because as a non-MRI person, it's much easier for me to see the lesions on our PSMA PET scans than on the MRI scan. So nuclear medicine, you know, when I was training, used to be called unclear medicine, but the technology has evolved and now it's very clear. Whereas I think the MRIs are perhaps more unclear. What's your thoughts on that?
So that's a great question, Michael. And if we start off with what the guidelines recommend, at the moment, none of the guidelines recommend PSMA PET for primary diagnosis of prostate cancer, but we do have a large interest in trying to see what its role is. And the primary study, which was led from Peter Mack, investigated this with patients who had a PSMA PET and MRI, followed by a biopsy. And it showed that the additional value of PSMA PET really improved the negative predictive value in identifying significant cancer. So it does have a role, but one of the limitations of the primary study was that it was enriched with patients with high-risk PIRADS 2s or 3s who have been referred for further investigation. So those are the patients who potentially have a negative MRI with a PIRADS 2, but still a persistent clinical risk. They've been selected as having more likely to have cancer. And in that group of patients, the PSMA PET really did add some value. And as a population as a whole, the value that PSMA PET adds perhaps is slightly less. Of course, we need to think about how expensive the test is and its availability and whether or not it has a role in everyone. I don't think so. I think there are groups of patients in whom it could be really valuable for. The current group of patients in whom the primary two study, which is the randomized study based out of Peter Mack, which is looking at the role, is the patients with PIRADS 2s and PIRADS 3s. Who have potentially a negative type MRI phenotype or a low-risk MRI type phenotype with then a PSMA PET may add value in helping to reduce the need for a biopsy and ruling out significant cancer. I think there's the potential sweet spot with the cost of the scan and availability at the moment.
So I'll ask a bridging question about staging. Once we've secured the diagnosis, how are you staging patients? Are you using PSMA PET? And I know, Vera, you're working with Michael currently in your sabbatical at Peter Mac, but maybe Michael, you start and then Vera will tell us how he sees this evolving.
So currently, you know, in the Australian context, PSMA PET CT is now funded for staging of intermediate and high-risk prostate cancer. So that's grade group 3, 4, or 5. And we're doing a single PSMA PET scan. And that has essentially replaced both a contrast-enhanced CT and a bone scan. So patients are having one scan rather than two scans. And in that setting, when you use it as a replacement, at least in our health economics assessment, you actually save some money and it's beneficial for the patients. The single visit to the hospital and the scan's completed in, you know, under an hour and a half compared to a CT bone scan, which takes a substantial amount of time, particularly the bone scan. You know, you might not realize, but a bone scan, you inject the radiotracer, you wait 4 hours, and then you do a scan that takes over half an hour. So this is half a day of a patient's life to go off and have a bone scan, and the results are much less accurate than a PSMA PET. So we're no longer performing bone scans in that setting.
So, I mean, I realize half a day, I think, is optimistic. I think our patients are using most of the day to have their bone scan. But the challenge, and we've discussed this before, is that the data that emerged from the STAMPEDE trial, that's split patients by low versus high volume, and identified a very significant benefit in survival for the low volume patients. And I guess we can debate the definition there, but that was the one that was used. A significant benefit for radiation to the primary in the low, but not the high. And in terms of a predictive test, we have none currently in prostate cancer that beat bone scan in that setting. So despite all its limitations, some of which you've alluded to, making the decision on whether a patient has radiotherapy to the primary has level one evidence based on the bone scan. So how do you address that?
So I guess for staging, the main question is not high volume versus low volume, but it's, is there any nodal disease? Is there any metastatic disease? And the decision is whether to do a radical prostatectomy or radical radiotherapy. So that's the majority of these patients. So that question is not coming into play. When you do identify metastatic disease, then you're going to embark on systemic therapies, and that question will come into play. And, you know, I'll be the first to acknowledge that the data is not available for PSMA PET, and it's not because it's not going to be better than bone scan at distinguishing low versus high volume. It's because when that data was acquired, PSMA PET was not available. And so I think what's happened in Australia is probably a common sense approach. Once the technology is available and used, it does seem that bone scans are rarely requested. And it does seem that clinicians in cooperation with multidisciplinary meetings are using the data from the PSMA PET and a common sense approach to decide, yes, should this patient have radiotherapy to the prostate bed in addition to systemic therapy with ADT or other treatments? And at the same time, you'll be the first to acknowledge that increasingly patients are having anti-androgen-directed therapies such as abiraterone and enzalutamide and others early on, and that even in that setting, the data about whether to give radiotherapy to the prostate bed is uncertain. So unfortunately, the data is always evolving. Technologies are evolving, both diagnostics and new treatments, and we need to use some common sense, clinical pragmatism and judgment to decide how to treat the individual patient in front of us with all the information we have available. But you can always go back and do the bone scan in these tricky cases where you really want to do exactly what was done in the clinical trial to make a decision. But I think that's probably going to be a minority of patients. So, for example, if your PSMA PET shows 50 metastases, you're not really going to wonder, is this low volume or high volume? So this is a question that may arise in a certain smaller group of patients.
I'd say, fortunately, the technology is evolving. But it is making our life more complicated. And Vera, hopefully, we'll be working together next year. So you will be doing PSMA PETs on all your patients, and then I'll come to my clinic and I'll be doing bone scans, at least for a subset. Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, look, I do agree with Michael on this one. And I think having come from the NHS setting where PSMA PET was done occasionally in the primary staging setting, to where it's done pretty much in every patient, I have been able to see the pros and cons and what the next 5 to 10 years in our MDMs and MDTs will look like. The discussions that we have will be the same ones that we're having in our MDMs at Peter Mac. Look, I think the pro-PSMA study was quite clear in its findings that PSMA PET was superior to bone scan for diagnostic test performance. And now the question is, how much evidence do you need to change practice? Do you wait for the evidence to accumulate, or do you change practice now? I haven't seen many studies where the test performance characteristics of a new test are so much better than the other one. This is actually quite a clear study to me where it makes sense to try and change practice, and we can generate some evidence as we do that. We won't necessarily be able to generate the same evidence that we have with bone scan and CT, but I think rational decision-making in an MDT setting with some of that information is the way to go. But I don't think we should ignore the more accurate information that we're getting from PSMA PET.
Excellent. So moving to the other end of the disease spectrum, so MCRPC, where you've made so many important contributions, Michael, in addition to your work in staging. So therapy. And your most recent controversial result, not controversial, I guess result that people have been discussing in the past few days at ESMO, was the absence of survival in the patients randomized between carbazitaxel versus 617. And in your talk, you alluded to crossover. But if I've got my maths right, that only explains about 30% of patients who had carbazitaxel subsequently had 617. I guess it's that of patients who've progressed. It's actually a higher proportion receiving crossover. And your thoughts to explain that result?
Yeah, look, it was a phase two trial, 200 patients, so 100 patients in each arm. And if we take the carbazitaxel arm, 15 withdrew post-randomization, and another 20 patients had a crossover post-carbazitaxel. So that's, 35 patients out of the 100 that we kind of lose. So in this small trial, that does result in an underpowering effect. Likewise, in the lutetium arm, 30% had carbazitaxel after lutetium. We didn't see the dropouts. So in some sense, the study was not comparing survival with lutetium compared to carbazitaxel, but survival with the addition of lutetium as a treatment option. And perhaps another way to look at that is that the survival was around 18 months in both arms. Now, if you compare that to the CARD trial of carbazitaxel, survival in the carbazitaxel arm was around 15 months. So there seems to be inferior survival in that data in an otherwise quite similar population. But even if we accept what you say is true, which it may be, I mean, that's the ultimate result, is that survival was not different. Let's say it's not due to crossover or other effects, but that is real. I think it tells us that carbazitaxel is an effective therapy, which we knew before, but it really reinforces that we should be thinking about using carbazitaxel, that it is a life-prolonging therapy. Certainly, lutetium should not replace carbazitaxel. And, I was maybe just slightly disappointed at the amount of patients who received carbazitaxel post-lutetium in the therapy study. It was around 30%, and I think it should be higher. And I don't think that's because carbazitaxel couldn't have been delivered. I think there's a little bit of underutilization. People might even forget about it as an option. And you need to know when to stop lutetium, when to switch to that valuable treatment option. Another analogy is, even if it's just as effective as carbazitaxel but doesn't prolong life, let's accept that the crossover is not the effect. There's no question that the side effect profile and quality of life was better in the lutetium arm. So costs aside, if you have the option of two treatments with the same survival, but one has, you know, a big difference in quality of life, you're going to choose that option. And we've seen that in the castration-sensitive space. When abiraterone became available, survival was not superior to docetaxel, but patient tolerance, the quality of life was. So patients moved towards wanting abiraterone and then enzalutamide. So I think this is a similar situation here, where you have a new drug where your quality of life will be better. And that's really important in your last year and a half of life. I think just one last point, what maybe the Kaplan-Meier survival curves and underestimates is a small group of patients that do have what I'd call exceptional responses. The Kaplan-Meier survival curves are medians, and the outliers on both sides are sometimes underrepresented in a Kaplan-Meier survival curve. And we do see a group of patients, and I think we can see that in the tail of that of the PFS curve, who really have deep and quite durable responses to lutetium PSMA, more so than carbazitaxel. And this is a bit of clinical experience. It's a small group of patients. It's certainly under 20% of the cohort. We could debate what number within that range. But these are patients that we're seeing alive four and a half, even 5 years after lutetium therapies, and even post-carbazitaxel. So we just must remember that group. And it does seem that we've got some biomarkers that might predict these patients that are more likely to respond.
So that's
a mind if I
yeah.
Do you mind if I ask I make a comment and ask a question to Michael as well? So, you know, when I'm not in the operating theatre, you'll probably find me in a nuclear medicine department. As Michael will know, I'm often sitting next to him looking at PSMA PET scans these days. But the thing I did notice when we saw these patients in therapy is the quality of life point that Michael made. These patients after treatment really are, when they have symptoms, much improved and a lot quite quickly, almost, you know, the next day after treatment. And to have quite a low side effect profile, I haven't seen many treatment paradigms where you have a new treatment where their side effect profile is so much better and patients really, really want it. And I think that's quite clear. But my question relates to the quality of life. And, you know, this is not a cheap treatment. It's an expensive treatment per cycle. And cost effectiveness will be a major consideration as to whether or not this type of approach could be used in a more widespread, generalizable setting. Do you have any comments, Michael, about what you think the cost effectiveness will be like compared to existing treatments?
Yeah, I must have a caveat that I'm not a health economist. You know, perhaps there are analogies here, again, to the hormone-sensitive space, docetaxel versus Abienza, where when that paradigm became available, you know, chemotherapy was cheaper. And the same questions were being asked. Do we want to use this drug that's quite expensive, has to be given every month, that doesn't improve survival but just improves quality of life? And over time, you know, the costs of treatments, the new treatments become cheaper and we have to reevaluate. Do need to take into account all the secondary costs, which are, you know, if you're in pain, you're on opiate analgesics. Many patients, you know, receiving lutetium therapy completely stop their pain relief tablets. Also, if you get febrile neutropenia with carbazitaxel and you end up in hospital or you need blood transfusions, these are all secondary costs that really need to be factored in, and it makes it much more complex than just the cost of the drug alone. And this is really where we need our health economists' expertise to factor in all these things into the equation, and it becomes a complex one.
So next question, Michael, for you is retreatment. And I picked your brains in, I guess, Lugano, that's where we were. your thoughts on retreatment? Because clearly we have patients who have exceptional responses and we watch them for 18 months. I have a few of those in my clinic. And then their PSA starts to rise again. What's your experience with retreatment?
Yeah, so we have been doing retreatment right from the beginning. We first started lutetium PSMA 617 back in 2015, so it's 7 years of experience now. And it's very hard when a patient has had a good response to a treatment and they progress. And in this case, we repeat the PSMA PET, and if there's still very high uptake, it's hard to deny that patient access to further lutetium when it's likely to work again. We have analogies to lutetium dotatate in neuroendocrine tumors where we always use the retreatment span. We know that it's safe. You know, after six cycles of treatment, we're not reaching any critical dose-limiting cumulative toxicities. So we will individualize this. Our practice at the moment is post six cycles when a patient progresses. We'll usually give an additional two cycles, so cycle 7 and 8, and then wait for response, and we will repeat that after discussion in a multidisciplinary meeting. There are some patients where we've given 13 or 14 cycles of lutetium, and I would say I even struggle to remember a patient who has stopped lutetium therapy because of either intolerance or toxicity. So the reason we are stopping lutetium is because the duration of response does get shorter and shorter. This is a definite phenomenon. So that by cycle 13, 14, either you're progressing with PSMA negative disease and it's just simply not effective, or the durability of response is simply totally inadequate. So that seems to be about the ceiling. Many patients don't even get to anywhere near that. But in this smaller group of patients who seem to keep responding, you know, we can get up to around, you know, 13, 14 cycles without much in the way of difficulty. Not much published data on this yet, so it can be challenging. I know it's not approved in that setting. We certainly have published our own data in our first 50 patient series with rechallenge, and the PSA over 50% response rate in patients when we rechallenged was 73%, so very high. But the duration of response was shorter.
And 617 has really pushed radium-223, I guess, off that first choice list. But once a patient progresses with 617 and only has bone disease, what are your thoughts on radium at that point?
Look, that's a very good question. And strangely, radium-223 was never reimbursed in Australia. So although it's available and approved, it's not reimbursed. It's some weird quirk of the Australian healthcare system that it was never funded, despite a recommendation by the government to accept it. So we don't have a lot of experience with using radium. And certainly lutetium PSMA 617 has totally displaced radium use in Australia. But as you allude to, you know, the predominant pattern of recurrence is in bone. We do know that radium is an effective bone-seeking radionuclide. So it's definitely of interest. There is safety data showing that you can still deliver lutetium therapy after radium or vice versa. And we actually have an interest in this. And we've just opened a study called the Alpha BET trial, alpha for the radium, beta for the lutetium. We're actually going to combine the two. So this is a trial of lutetium PSMA in combination with radium-223, given at the same time every 6 weeks. We're going to do this in patients with bone-predominant disease because we are mindful that this is where patients are progressing. Three-quarters are progressing in bone. It does seem that soft tissue disease, particularly nodal, but also visceral disease, adrenal, lung, even brain metastases, are having much better responses than bone. So bone does seem to be this more resistant site, and site where prostate cancer seems to progress. So we are interested in whether addition of radium can improve things, but also provide some safety data as to whether the two can be given simultaneously.
So my last question, you alluded to timing as an opportunity to potentially improve the outcomes at 617 And we've seen that over the past decade, moving drugs earlier and earlier, specifically to the MHSBC state. Those trials are ongoing, but I'd value your thoughts on the challenges and opportunities of Lu-617 for MHSBC.
Yeah, that's a great question, Gerd. Look, I think first thing to say is it shouldn't be done off trials. You know, this is a clinical trial question. We shouldn't be displacing life-prolonging proven therapies because lutetium, you know, patients are requesting it. I think that, you know, the patients are all talking in online groups, and as Vero alluded to, it is well tolerated and quality of life are improvement. So we have lots of patients requesting earlier use, patient-driven requests, and we think we should be driven by high-quality data. So it should not be used early on. But we have clinical trials underway that will answer this question. And I think the two challenges are, one, durability of response. You know, this is, if there is a disappointment to lutetium PSMA in the advanced disease, is that some of these very deep responses that I called exceptional, I try to avoid that word because, you know, 3-4 months later, the patients can be progressing and they can be progressing rapidly. And that's not very exceptional for the patient. So will the durability be better in the hormone-sensitive space? It's an unanswered question. If the durability is no better, that will be a significant limitation. I think the other challenge is long-term toxicities. Although it's really well tolerated, this is a form of radiation delivery. And in that way, it's got analogies to external beam radiation rather than another drug. So if you irradiate someone's kidneys with external beam radiation, the drop in renal function doesn't occur the following day, like with a drug, or even within a few weeks. It occurs many months later. So we do know that we may see some delayed toxicities after radiation. And that really hasn't perhaps been well defined in the castration resistant setting where survival is unfortunately so poor. But if we're going to use it in patients who have a 10 or 15 year survival, we just need to evaluate those long-term toxicities carefully. There may not be any, but we need to, if we don't look, we won't know. And so this is another reason to study things carefully so that we don't get any surprises long-term.
Agreed. So we could discuss this for so much longer, but I'm going to draw it to a close. You started the presentation, Michael, by saying it's taken less than a decade, or you implied the decade wasn't was for loop for PSMA 617 was shorter than for the other theranostics, and a decade is probably too long. It probably have been much longer if without your contribution, and both of you, you know, really captured all the salient clinical points, but also introduced so much insight, so many insights into future opportunities and how this field is going to keep advancing and really turbocharged by your research. So thank you both for taking out time to present these data.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.